From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
The Whispers by Hugh B. Cave. It was a very old, very forlorn house. To reach it, we had to climb over a broken gate on which hung a for sale sign, and then wade through a sea of grass that had grown rampant. "Darling," Anne said, "this is it. Let's buy it." I stared at her. We had been married a week, but I could still not even glance at her without wanting to take her in my arms. "We could fix the house up and come here weekends, at least," she insisted. I was thinking we might actually live here full time because, being a writer, I could live anywhere. An hour later, we were in the village, talking to Jedney Prentice, whose name and address were on the sign. The price he quoted was reasonable enough, I thought. "And it's still a mighty fine house, even though it's been empty for 6 years," he said. We drove to Harkness, then, to arrange the transfer. That afternoon, we lit a fire in the big fireplace and burned the road maps. Then we picked out the room we wanted for our bedroom and went to work, determined to have at least that much done by nightfall. Anne had bought bedding and some furniture in Harkness, and the store people had promised to deliver them at once. It was great fun. To save her dress, Anne peeled down to shorts and a halter, and there she was, running around the almost nude, with mops and brooms, dusters, and buckets of water. I watched her out of one eye and realized what a lucky man I was. It was about 6 o'clock when our company arrived. Anne had gone out into the yard for some birch twigs to make an auxiliary broom. I was on my knees in bedroom debris. Suddenly, from the doorway at my back, a voice said, "You ain't gonna live here, are you, mister?" I swung about, startled half out of my skin. There on the threshold stood a sickly, emaciated little girl about 12 years old. Pity for the poor creature overwhelmed me, and I stood up slowly for fear of frightening her. "And who are you?" I asked. "A neighbor of ours?" "I used to live here. I'm Susie Callister." Jedney Prentice had mentioned the Callisters. They were local people who had rented the place for a time. After the death of Jim Callister, his wife and little girl had moved out. "You people must be crazy, moving into this place," the girl said. "My ma says it's haunted."
"Really?"
"She'd lick the tar out of me if she knew I was here."
"And do you come here often?" I asked.
"Yep. Pa died here. He was swell. I come here to talk to him."
"You come here to what?"
"Well," she said defiantly, "maybe I don't talk to him like me and you are talking, but I talk and he listens. I sit in a box down in the cellar and tell him how Ma won't let me come here. He whispers back sometimes. He died there in the cellar from a heart attack."
"Peter," that was Anne's voice from downstairs, "I've made coffee and sandwiches. It's after 6, and I'm starved."
"Gee," Susie Callister whispered, "is it that late? I'll get killed." She turned like a frightened rabbit, then stopped. In a low, pleading voice, she added, Can I come here sometimes to talk to Pa? Can I, please?"
Something told me there was a story in this little girl, so I said she could come as often as she liked. She fled downstairs and out the front door, slamming it behind her. When I got downstairs, Anne was standing in the hall shadows, a queer look on her face.
"Who is that, Peter?"
I told her, and she seemed relieved. We sat down to our supper in the kitchen. Anne was oddly quiet. She was tired, I supposed. Walking around the table, I put my hands on her shoulder and said, "You're working too hard." She smiled a little and relaxed against me, but she was trembling and suddenly looked up at me.
"Peter, before we do anything else after supper, will you go down to the cellar and look around? I was down there a while ago, and I think we have rats. I heard the strangest whispering sounds over and near an old workbench."
"I'll exterminate the vipers," I said lightly, but Anne was afraid I knew it by the way she clung to me.
I didn't go into the cellar right away.
Our purchases arrived, and we had to arrange furniture. Night was upon us in earnest before I got around to the rats. Clutching an antique oil lamp, I groped down the steep, treacherous cellar stairs, put the lamp on the workbench, and looked around. It was a huge room with floors and walls of rough concrete, the floor unfinished or long ago torn up for some reason, in the corner under the bench. My mind played with a distressing mental picture of Susie Callister, poor child, sitting here, alone in the dark, pouring out her sorrows to her dead father. Something would have to be done about Susie Callister and about the rats whose whisperings she believed to be her father's voice. The rats? Seated on an upturned box, I waited. Presently, I, too, heard a furtive whispering. It seemed to come from the section of the cellar where the floor had been torn up. Noiselessly, I stalked the sound. Rats? I was not so sure. This odd, subtle whispering was too seductive. I could have sworn it was trying to tell me something. On hands and knees, I crept toward the corner where the floor was bare. The sound ceased. Carefully, I explored every inch of the packed brown earth, but found nothing. Had the rats bored a tunnel beneath this part of the cellar? Did rats make tunnels? I took a step toward the lamp and stopped. Something unbelievably cold, yet soft as the touch of a woman's lips, caught at my left ankle. My heart missed a beat. Through me swept the kind of thrill that might seethe in a man if a beautiful woman were suddenly to appear naked before him out of nowhere. I looked down and could have sworn, though nothing was there, that something like a human hand had hold of my foot. Then a dull creaking noise stiffened me. I jerked loose, raised my head, and saw that the bulkhead at the far end of the cellar was being raised. There was the explanation of my clutching hand, simply an inrush of cold air from the night outside. I stared. Framed in the aperture was a pair of legs garbed in coarse black stockings. Then a groping hand appeared, followed by a woman's face. Furtively, the intruder descended the old wooden steps to the cellar door. Apparently, she did not see me, and that was strange, for the lamp still burned. Slowly, she advanced. Her dress was a cheap black rug that accented the paleness of her face and throat. Prowling past the bench, she stopped. Her voice, a sibilant whisper, scratched along the cellar walls. "She's been here again, Jim Callister, hasn't she? I know it. I could tell by the look in her eyes when she got home. She comes here more often than I know, and you talk to her. You put ideas into her head. But you ain't gonna get her, damn you. I'll take her so far away, you won't never get your hellish hairy hands on her. You hear? I'm defying you. I stood up to you once, and I'm doing it again." She shook her fist. Her calcimine face was shapeless with hate. I swear I could hear the machine gun beat of her heart beneath that ragged black dress. Sharply, I said, "Wait, Mrs. Callister." She stopped as though stabbed. Her glittering eyes searched for me and finally found me. I realized then why she had not seen me before. She was half blind. "It's quite all right, Mrs. Callister," I said. "I'm Peter Winslow, and I've bought this house. I'd like to talk to you if..." Flinging herself backward, she whirled toward the bulkhead, and before I could make a move to stop her, the darkness outside had swallowed her. Bewildered and afraid, I went upstairs. That night, we heard the rats. Anne pressed herself against me, her sweet body trembling with terror. I tried to comfort her, but even while doing so, I thought darkly, "The rats are in the cellar. Susie Callister's father died there. Susie is a strange child, and her mother is a strange woman. No ordinary rats ever whispered like that." In the morning, I drove alone to the village to buy traps. The proprietor of the general store was a thin, bony man. "So you're the feller bought the old Prentice place," he said when I introduced myself. "Like it there, do you?" "I think we might when it's fixed up." He gave me an oblique look. "Paint and repairs will help a heap, but they won't alter what happened to Jim Callister. I'm the undertaker here, and I prepared Jim for burying. You can't tell me he died natural." And I said so till I was hoarse, but nobody listened. "What do you mean?" I demanded. "Well, he was working down in the cellar the night he died. Seems he spent most of his spare time working there. So this night it was mighty quiet down there, and his wife got worried. She went down and found him laying there." Or so she said. He snorted. Doc Digby called it a heart attack. But I took care of the body, like I said, and I never heard of a heart attack growing hair on a man.
Hair?
Outside of his face. There wasn't an inch of Jim Callister that didn't have hair on it. Hair like you see on a dog or a wolf.
I gave him a long, hard stare, trying to figure him out. Another thing he said, when I pumped Jim Callister clean, I didn't like what came out of him.
I could only stare at him and say weakly, I don't understand.
Smelled funny and looked funny. If you ask me, he was poisoned.
But what? Why?
Can't talk to you no more.
Said too much already, I expect.
Abruptly, he turned his back on me.
I thought about it on the way home and decided to have another look at that cellar and to have a talk with Dr. Digby at the first opportunity. Then I found the car, a rather ancient vintage, parked at our gate, and its doctor's emblem indicated our caller was a medical man. He was. A bald little man in his 60s, he stopped talking to Anne and introduced himself as Everett Digby. The hand he offered me was like a wet rubber glove.
Thought I'd drop in to say hello, he said with a mechanical smile.
You thought you'd drop in to see if we actually intended to live here, I mentally corrected.
You know something about this house, about Jim Callister, that you don't want us to find out.
We talked for half an hour about nothing. Finally, after a cautious build-up, I said,
the fellow at the store seems to think there was something strange about Jim Callister's death.
Digby laughed. Better take Ben with a grain of salt. He makes his own liquor, and it does queer things to him. I thought, one of you is lying. Anne excused herself and went to prepare lunch. Then Digby suddenly changed his manner. Leaning toward me, he said in a low voice,
you are insane to buy this place, Winslow. What Ben Nevins told you is right, or partly right anyhow. There was something odd about Callister's death, and this house was the cause of it. If I were you, I'd clear out.
Why?
He shot a glance at the kitchen door.
I'll tell you what I know and leave out what I think. Jim Callister came here to live 3 years ago. At first, everything went fine. Then he built a workbench down in the cellar and things began happening. He got thin and worried. His wife begged me to look at him and I did. And it stumped me. There wasn't a thing wrong with him that I could discover. Yet his skin was turning soft and white. And little clumps of hair were growing out of it. And he was changing mentally. Jim had been a fine fellow with a big hearty laugh. Now he was grim as a grave and becoming sort of sly and stealthy.
He got worse before his death, I asked.
Well, I wouldn't know about the condition of his body. After that first examination, he wouldn't let me look at him again. But according to his wife, he got more surly by the day. She and their little girl went through hell.
And you believe this house has something to do with it?
Digby looked away, moistening his lips.
Something changed him. I don't know what. All I say is you ought to clear out of here for your own safety. There are things in this world we don't understand, Winslow. I don't know what turned Jim Callister into a vicious, hairy beast, but...
He caught himself, but it was too late. Anne was there in the doorway.
Digby stood up, little lines of sweat forming on his bald head.
Got to be going, he mumbled.
Said more than I meant to. He hurried out to his car. When he had gone, Anne turned to me and said quietly,
what did he mean about Jim Callister, Peter?
Nothing, darling.
I want you to tell me,
I told her, selecting with care the words I used.
I have a feeling something unpleasant happened in this house, and he may have had a part in it, I concluded. My hunch is that he wants to scare us out of here before we find out about it. But even as I put my arms around her and kissed her, I was thinking of something else, of those whispers in the cellar. That evening, while knocking down some old shelves in the kitchen, I felt a sharp shooting pain in my ankle. It disappeared almost at once, but at the first opportunity I went upstairs, shut the bedroom door behind me, and removed my sock. A patch of graying white skin, peculiarly soft, extended from my instep to a point an inch or so above the shin bone. Thoroughly scared, I smeared it with salve and bound it, replacing sock and shoe. Then I began thinking of the cellar again. I had to go down there. Furtively I began seeking some excuse for leaving Anne upstairs, so that I might be alone down there to wait.
Wait for what? The whispers?
The opportunity came just before bedtime. Anne had undressed and donned her pajamas. We were having a nightcap in the kitchen. As a bridegroom, I should have been gazing at my wife and thinking something like, "This lovely woman is mine, to have, to hold, and to love." But what I said to her was, "Do you go on upstairs, darling. I have to set those traps in the cellar." She looked at me queerly, but I turned away and went down the cellar stairs, closing the door behind me. Unerringly, my feet took me to the patch of brown earth near the workbench. There I waited. 10-15 minutes I waited, then the whispers again. Out of the earth they came. Out of the walls, sibilant, seductive sounds that seemed almost to be words. My hands trembled, my whole body quivered with excitement. Dropping to hands and knees, I crawled towards the source of the sound, and suddenly my hands were claws, frantically digging in the earth. Now the whispers mocked me. They beat against my brain, tormenting me, spurring me on to greater efforts. I clawed like an animal, like a dog digging for a bone. Before long, I had dug a hole nearly 2 feet deep and encountered wood. It was a cistern cover. I could not budge it, but I found a crowbar back of the furnace and worked like a madman with sweat rolling down my face and arms until slowly, bit by bit, I broke the seal of concrete that held the cover in place. Then, using all my strength, I pried it up and managed to move it to one side. There in the black depths of the cellar, I dropped to my hands and knees to peer into a yawning pit, and from the depths of it rose a sigh, half human, half animal, that seemed to convey all the world's sadness. I seized my flashlight and aimed its beam into the pit. The walls leaped into frightening prominence. Gray, wet walls they were, covered with a fungus growth that seemed to writhe in agony as the light touched it. But the depths of the cistern still tenaciously held her secret. Powerful as the light was, it revealed only vertical walls vanishing into a deep, seemingly impenetrable darkness. A whispering darkness. A darkness full of nameless rustlings that called to me. The cellar had grown unbearably cold. My flesh crawled. I retreated in dismay from the pit's edge. But a clammy, freezing chill enveloped me, as though invisible hands had stripped me naked and were rubbing me with ice. Sharp, biting pain attacked my chest and arms. Then came the fear. Fear of the dark, of the pit, of the crowding cellar walls. Sobbing out of my terror, I swung the cistern cover back into place and clawed some earth over it. Then I fled. When I entered the bedroom, Anne was lying there in bed with a magazine waiting for me. "Peter," she cried, "you're so pale. What's wrong?" I crept into bed and crushed her against me, desperately afraid that something might come between us. "Darling," she whispered without complaint, though God knows I must have been brutally hurting her. "Darling, you're upset." Then her lips found mine, and my fears at last subsided. In the morning, Anne rose quietly, thinking me asleep and wanting not to wake me, but I was awake. I lay with one eye half open, watching her. I remembered the whispers and what they had commanded me to do. She had planned to drive to Harkness that morning for curtain material and a few other things we needed. I heard her go, then stealthily, I slipped out of bed, peeled off my pajamas, and studied myself naked in a mirror. God help me, I liked what I saw. I dressed and went downstairs. Anne had left breakfast on the table. I ate slowly, filled with thoughts of her, of what was going to happen, had to happen, when she returned. Suddenly I heard the front door open and the voice of Susie Callister calling anxiously. "Is anybody home?" The voice with which I answered her was not my voice. Oh, no. They told me what to say. They told me to invite the child in and humor her. I called to her, and she came timidly into the kitchen and stood staring at me. You said I could come sometimes," she reminded me. "You said I could talk to Pa." "My dear child, of course. If I go downstairs, you won't tell Ma I'd done it, will you?" Her deep-set eyes were pleading with me. Her lips trembled. "She licked me something off for the last time. She says we're going to move away from here. Tomorrow, maybe. I want to say goodbye to Pa." Smiling, I took her by the arm and led her down the hall to the cellar door and opened it, then stood there at the top of the treacherous cellar stairs watching her while she slowly descended into the darkness. She was young, of course. Her frail little body was not very attractive. Still, her skin was white and clear. She had arms and legs and the beginnings of breasts. She was better than nothing. I heard the whispers, and they were evil. Never before had they been so loud, so commanding. They told me what to do next. I closed the door softly and turned the key. Then I went back to the sitting room and sat to wait. It came at last, and every expectant nerve in my body thrilled it as a lover to a subtle caress. A scream of terror pulsed up from the dark cellar. A sudden rush of footfall sounded on the stairs. Frantic fists beat against the locked door. Then the scream soared again, this time a wailing, tenuous cry that fluttered for a moment in space, then died. And I sat there smiling with my twisted mind and sated senses, soaking up every last lingering echo until the house was quiet again. There were no whispers when I opened the cellar door. Descending, I looked about me. My little friend had said farewell to more than her dead father. She had vanished. "There will be another soon," I promised softly. "Just be patient." The woman came about an hour later. Angrily, she strode up the porch steps and banged on the front door. And then I opened the door to her when she thrust her contorted face at me and said shrilly, "Susie came here, didn't she? Where is she?" "My dear Mrs. Callister," I murmured, "what on earth makes you think?" "Don't lie to me. I know that child like a book." "Come in, Mrs. Callister," I invited. "Look for yourself." She stormed into the house, stabbing a quick glance into the sitting room and dining room. She strode down the hall to the kitchen. "Susie, Susie, are you hiding from me, you little she-devil? Susie, where are you?" I followed her from room to room, slyly watching her. She would please them. She was shapely. Her legs were nicely rounded. Her mature body gleamed white as snow through the gaps in her worn-out black dress. Upstairs we went, down again and finally to the cellar door. There she hesitated. For one brief instant, the anger on her wretched face was supplanted by fear. I opened the door. I ain't going down there," she whispered. "My dear Mrs. Callister, why not?" "I just ain't." Her voice rose to a screech. "Susie, are you down there?" It seemed strange to me that she could not hear the whispers. I could hear them. In fact, they were more than merely whispers, for mingled with them now was a kind of unearthly howling, as though down there in the gloom of the cellar a pack of wolves had gathered for some sort of feeding frenzy. I could hear them plainly and knew exactly what was being demanded of me. Very carefully, I stepped back, so carefully that Mrs. Callister did not notice. I looked at my hands and raised them slowly, slowly, until they were poised only a few inches from her shoulders. One savage thrust, and Susie Callister's mother would go screaming down the stairs. Then I would wrench the door shut, turn the key again, and... But at that moment, I heard the front door open, and my wife's voice called, "Peter, will you help me get the things out of the car, please? There's more than I can manage by myself." I closed the cellar door and went along the hall. Mrs. Callister followed me, and her arms laden, stopped short. "This is Mrs. Callister, and she's under the mistaken impression that her daughter is here. I've been having a difficult time trying to convince her otherwise." Mrs. Callister said something under her breath and went past us to the door. Then she stopped. Too late, I saw the tiny frayed handkerchief lying there on the hall table. She snatched it up and looked at it, her eyes yellow with venom. Fiercely, she turned to confront me. "I know," she whispered. "I know what you've done. You've turned into one of them, like Jim did." Then with a shriek, she fled. "The woman is mad," I said to Anne. "This is the damnedest village full of the queerest people." "Well, she's gone. That's something to be thankful for." Anne was silent, but the look she gave me was strange. All morning she kept an eye on me. In the afternoon she said, "Peter, why don't you lie down and rest a bit? I think you've been working too hard." "I think I will." "Please, you're not yourself, darling. You frighten me a little." I went upstairs and shut the door. To sleep? Oh no, I lay on the bed thinking of the promise I had made. When night fell, I would keep it. But night came so slowly. I lay there counting the minutes. I watched the room grow dark. I thought my wife would never stop puttering around downstairs. Hungrily, I listened to every sound she made, to the soft tap-tapping of her heel as she went from room to room, to the murmur of the portable radio on the fireplace mantel. I cursed her for being so stubborn. When she entered the bedroom at last, I pretended to be asleep. She set a lamp on the chest of drawers and turned the wick low, so not to wake me. Obliquely, I watched her undress. Pretty, so pretty. Did she know I was watching? Once, just once. She turned abruptly to look at me and for a moment stood absolutely motionless, as though my furtive gaze had actually caught her attention. Then she put out the lamp and groped toward me in the dark and got into bed with me. By the sound of her breathing, I knew that her back was towards me. I became aware of the warmth and subtle fragrance of her body. I waited with devilish patience until I was certain she slept. Then I seized her. She screamed only once as my hands closed about her lovely throat. Her eyes flew open and I saw the whites of them staring up at me in the dark. Her lips whispered my name as I tore at her pajamas. Dragging her from the bed, I gathered her up in my arms and prowled to the door, leaving the torn remnants of her night garb in a pitiful heap on the floor. If I kissed her mouth and crushed her against me in a wild, hungry embrace, it was not for love, for by that time I was laughing, and the low, bestial laughter that poured from my throat was not even remotely human. "They want you," I howled. Down the dark stairs I carried her to the lower hall, and now the old house was alive with howlings and echoes of howlings, urging me on down the hall toward the cellar stairs I went. All at once I heard voices and heavy footsteps on the porch. I stopped. A snarl curled my lip. Lowering my limp burden, I prowled stealthily through the sitting room to a window and crouched there peering out. There were many of them, and they carried every conceivable kind of weapon. Up from the village they had come, led by the mother of the girl I had locked in the cellar, and by Everett Digby, the doctor, who knew more about this house than he had admitted. Even as I watched, Digby hammered the door with his fist and demanded admittance, while the others crowded closer, their faces grim and gaunt in the glare of flashlights and lanterns. "Open the door, we'll break it down," I slunk from the window. For a moment I thought wildly of confronting them, but the beast I had become was afraid, and yet there might still be time to thwart them if I could reach the cellar in time. Trembling and afraid, I crept into the hall. There lay my wife, mercifully unaware of my intentions, her sweet body a white, soft heap on the floor, and the howlings were thunder in my brain, lashing me, driving me on. I stooped to seize Anne's arm to drag her, but there was not enough time. The door crashed inward and I wheeled in a crouch, snarling like a predatory beast driven from its prey. For one terrible moment, I faced the mob, faced the awful accusation in the eyes of Everett Digby, and the burning hatred in the stare of Mrs. Callister. Then a rifle cracked and a bullet splintered the ancient timbers of the cellar door next to me. I whirled and ran, leaving my wife there on the floor. With animal strength and cunning, I sped through the kitchen, tore open the rear door, and fled into the night. Darkness closed around me. At top speed, I fled through the rank grass of the yard to the vast black shelter of the woods, easily escaping the frenzied swing of their searchlights. There, exhausted, I lay snarling and watched. That night will live long in the memory of those people. An ambulance came from the Harkness Hospital. Men in white rushed into the house with an empty stretcher and rushed out again with someone, my wife, I desperately hope, lying on it. The ambulance raced away. Lanterns moved in weird procession through the blackness as men from the village hunted me. Flashlights were glittering, fireflies swarming in the night. Voices, some angry, some fearful, rode the breeze, and heavy feet tramped through the underbrush, sometimes within yards of the patch of brambles in which I cowered. I waited. They will give up soon, I thought. Then I can go back. But in that I was mistaken, for as the first dull gray of dawn appeared, a crimson glow sprang up to rival it. Flames rose to the sky, devouring the ancient timbers of my honeymoon house. Huge clouds of smoke billowed up from the inferno. I crept as close as I dared, and from the fringe of woods I cursed the flames and the grim-faced men who stood by watching the house burn. I cursed the truck that came at daybreak where the blackened foundations had cooled. I silently reviled the men who sweated there in the dawnlight, mixing concrete into which to fill the cistern in the cellar. When they departed, I crept into the woods again, bitterly cursing my fate. For this I knew. In the cellar of that house had existed the doorway to another world, one to which I was now irrevocably committed, but to which, God help me, I could never return. The taint of that world, its foulness, its corruption, had touched me as it had touched the father of little Susie Calloway. Susie was part of that world now, too, unless they had wanted her for something else. But even if she lived as one of them, I would never see her again. I was doomed to spend the remainder of my existence alone, unable to return to them, and never to see my beloved aunt again. With that understanding came another, which must have been lurking just under the surface of my consciousness. How clear it all seemed now. Working there in the cellar, Jim Callister, too, must have fallen prey to the whisperers. They had turned him into the kind of creature I had now become. His wife had seen it happening. Had he actually died of a heart attack? More likely of poison, as she tried desperately to save his soul and protect herself and the child. Poison, as the undertaker fellow had suspected. And if so, Dr. Digby must have helped her, for she was a simple woman who would have no knowledge of poisons and no access to them. How I wish my wife had poisoned me. And so, this letter, this manuscript, this confession, or whatever you may choose to call it, I have written it laboriously, using pencil stubs and scraps of paper gathered from trash cans in the village, where I prowl at night in search of food. I will leave it tonight under a stone on the steps of the Harkness Church, where someone, perhaps the pastor, will be sure to find it. Then I shall go away. Where to? God knows. The world of the whispers is forever closed to me, and in the world of men I have no place. Day by day the lines of my face change. My lips recede over teeth that are slowly becoming fangs. My eyes grow smaller and more luminous. My head shrinks into the bulges of my shoulder. Day by day, the cold white skin of my misshapen body becomes more hairy. Pray for me, please. I did not ask for this to happen.